"It's a medical test," Barbara replied, filling out the form. "You volunteered for it, remember? We're paying you for this, and after it's over, you can go back home."
"When did I do that?"
"Last week," Dr. Archer told her.
"I don't remember."
"Well, you did. We have your signature on the consent form. And we're taking good care of you, aren't we?"
"I feel dopey all the time."
"That's normal," Dr. Archer assured her. "It's nothing to worry about." She, subject F4, was a legal secretary. Three of the women subjects were that, which was mildly troubling to Dr. Archer. What if the lawyers they worked for called the police? Letters of resignation had been sent, with the signatures expertly forged, and plausible explanations for the supposed event included in the text of the letters. Maybe it would hold up. In any case, the kidnappings had been expertly done, and nobody here would talk to anybody about it, would they? Subject F4 was nude, and sitting in a comfortable cloth-covered chair. Fairly attractive, though she needed to lose about 10 pounds, Archer thought. The physical examination had revealed nothing unusual. Blood pressure was normal. Blood chemistry showed slightly elevated cholesterol, but nothing to worry about. She appeared to be a normal, healthy 26-year-old female. The interview for her medical history was similarly unremarkable. She was not a virgin, of course, having had 12 lovers over the 9 years of her sexual activity. One abortion carried out at age 20 by her gynecologist, after which she'd practiced safe sex. She had a current love interest, but he was out of town for a few weeks on business, and she suspected that he had another woman in his life anyway. "Okay, that about does it, Mary." Archer stood and smiled. "Thank you for your cooperation."
"Can I get dressed now?"
"First, there's something we want you to do. Please walk through the green door. There's a fogging system in there. You'll find it feels nice and cool. Your clothes will be on the other side. You can get dressed there."
"Okay."
Subject F4 rose and did as she was told. Inside the sealed room was nothing, really. She stood there in a drugged puzzlement for a few seconds, noting that it was hot in there, over 90 degrees. But then invisible spray ports in the wall sent out a mist. Fog, something like that, which cooled her down instantly and comfortably for about 10 seconds. Then the fog stopped, and the far door clicked open. As promised, there was a dressing room there, and she donned her green jams, then walked out into the corridor, where a security guard waved her to the door at the far end. He never got closer than 10 feet. Back to the dormitory, where lunch was waiting. Meals were pretty good here, and after meals, she always felt like a nap. "Feeling bad, Pete?" Dr. Kilgore asked in a different part of the building.
"Must be the flu or something. I feel beat up all over, and I can't keep anything down."
"Even the booze," he didn't say, though that was especially disconcerting for the alcoholic. Booze was the one thing he could always keep down.
"Okay, let's give it a look, then."
Kilgore stood, donning a mask and putting on latex gloves for his examination. "I gotta take a blood sample, okay?"
"Sure, Doc."
Kilgore did that very carefully indeed, giving him the usual stick inside the elbow and filling 4 5-cc test tubes. Next he checked Pete's eyes, mouth, and did the normal prodding, which drew a reaction over the subject's liver.
"Ouch! That hurts, Doc."
"Oh? Doesn't feel very different from before, Pete." "How's it hurt?" he asked, feeling the liver, which, as in most alcoholics, felt like a soft brick.
"Like you just stabbed me with a knife, Doc. Real sore there."
"Sorry, Pete." "How about here?" the physician asked. probing lower with both hands.
"Not as sharp, but it hurts a little. Something I ate, maybe?"
"Could be." "I wouldn't worry too much about it," Kilgore replied. Okay, this one was symptomatic, a few days earlier than expected. But small irregularities were to be expected. Pete was one of the healthier subjects, but alcoholics were never really what one could call healthy. So Pete would be number two.
"Bad luck, Pete," Kilgore thought. "Let me give you something to take the edge off."
The doctor turned and pulled open a drawer on the wall cabinet. 5 milligrams, he thought, filling the plastic syringe to the right line, then turning and sticking the vein on the back of the hand.
"Oh," Pete said a few seconds later. "Oh, that feels okay. A lot better, Doc. Thanks."
The rheumy eyes went wide, then relaxed.
Heroin was a superb analgesic, and, best of all, it gave its recipient a dazzling rush in the first few seconds, then reduced him to a comfortable stupor for the next few hours. So Pete would feel just fine for a while. Kilgore helped him stand, then sent him back. Next he took the blood samples off for testing. In 30 minutes he was sure. The antibody tests still showed positive, and microscopic examination showed what the antibodies were fighting against. And losing, too. Only 2 years earlier people had tried to infect America with the natural version of this bug, this shepherd's crook, some called it. It had been somewhat modified in the genetic engineering lab with the addition of cancer DNA to make this negative strand RNA virus more robust. But that was really like putting a raincoat on the bug. The best news of all was that the genetic engineering had more than tripled the latency period. Once thought to be 4 to 10 days, now it was almost a month. Maggie really knew her stuff, and she'd even picked the right name for it. Shiva was one nasty little son of a bitch. It had killed Chester. Well, the potassium had done that, but Chester had been doomed. And it was now starting to kill Pete. There would be no merciful help for this one. Pete would be allowed to live until the disease took his life. His physical condition was close enough to normal that they'd work to see what good supportive care would do to fight off the effects of the Ebola Shiva. Probably nothing, but they had to establish that. 9 remaining primary test subjects, and then 11 more on the other side of the building. They would be the real test. They were all healthy, or so the company thought. They'd be testing both the method of primary transmission and the viability of Shiva as a plague agent, plus the utility of the vaccines Steve Berg had isolated the previous week. That concluded Kilgore's work for the day. He made his way outside. The evening air was chilly and clean and pure. Well, as pure as it could be in this part of the world. There were 100 million cars in the country, all spewing their complex hydrocarbons into the atmosphere. Kilgore wondered if he'd be able to tell the difference in 2 or 3 years, when all that stopped. In the glow of the building lights, he saw the flapping of bats. Cool, he thought. One rarely saw bats. They must be chasing insects. And he wished his ears could hear the ultrasonic sounds they projected like radar to locate the bugs and intercept them. There would be birds up there, too. Owls, especially. Magnificent raptors of the night, flying with soft, quiet feathers, finding their way into barns, where they'd catch mice, eat and digest them, and then regurgitate the bones of their prey in compact little capsules. Kilgore felt far more kinship for the wild predators than he did for the prey animals. But that was to be expected, wasn't it? He did have kinship with the predators, those wild, magnificent things that killed without conscience,
because Mother Nature had no conscience at all. It gave life with one hand, and took it back with the other. The ageless process of life that had made the earth what it was. Men had tried so hard and so long to change it, but other men now would change it back, quickly and dramatically, and he'd be there to see it. He wouldn't see all the scars fade from the land, and that was too bad, but he judged he'd live long enough to see the important things change. Pollution would stop almost completely. The animals would no longer be fettered and poisoned. The sky would clear, and the land would soon be covered with life, as nature intended, with him and his colleagues to see the magnificence of the transformation. And if the price was high, then the prize it earned was worth it. The earth belonged to those who appreciated and understood her. He was even using one of nature's methods to take possession, albeit with a little human help. If humans could use their science and arts to harm the world, then other humans could use them to fix it. Chester and Pete would not have understood, but then they'd never understood much of anything, had they? "There will be thousands of Frenchmen there," Juan said, "and half of them will be children. If we wish to liberate our colleagues, the impact must be a strong one. This should be strong enough." "Where will we go afterwards?" Renee asked. "The Bekaa Valley is still available, and from there, wherever we wish. I have good contacts in Syria still, and there are always options. It's a 4-hour flight, and there is always an American aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean." "They will not attack an aircraft filled with children," Esteban pointed out. "They might even give us an escort," he added with a smile. "It is only 12 kilometers to the airport," André reminded them. "A fine multi-lane highway." "So then, we must plan the mission in every detail. Esteban, you will get yourself a job there. You too, André. We must pick our places, then select the time and the day."
"We'll need more men. At least 10 more.
"That is a problem."
"Where can we get 10 reliable men?" Juan asked.
"Sicarios can be hired."
"We need only promise them the right amount of money," Esteban pointed out.
"They must be faithful men," Rene told them forcefully.
"They will be faithful enough," the Basque told them. "I know where to go for them."
They were all bearded. It was the easiest disguise to adopt, and though the national police in their countries had pictures of them, the pictures were all of young, shaven men. A passerby might have thought them to be artists, the way they looked, and the way they all leaned inward on the table to speak with intense whispers. They were all dressed moderately well, though not expensively so. Perhaps they were arguing over some political issue, the waiter thought from his station 10 meters away, or some confidential business matter. He couldn't know that he was right on both counts. A few minutes later, he watched them shake hands and depart in different directions, having left cash to pay the bill, and, the waiter discovered, a niggardly tip. Artists, he thought. They were notoriously cheap bastards.
"But this is an environmental disaster waiting to happen," Carol Breitling insisted.
"Carol," the chief of staff replied, "it's about our balance of payments. It will save America something like $50 billion, and we need that. On the environmental side, I know what your concerns are, but the president of Atlantic Richfield has promised me personally that this will be a clean operation. They've learned a lot in the past 20 years, on the engineering side and the public relations side, about cleaning up their act, haven't they?"
"Have you ever been there?" the president's science advisor asked.
"Nope." He shook his head. "I've flown over Alaska, but that's it."
"You would think differently if you'd ever seen the place, trust me."
"They strip mine coal in Ohio. I've seen that.
And I've seen them cover it back up and plant grass and trees. Hell, one of those strip mines. In 2 years they're going to have the PGA Championship on the golf course that they built there. It's cleaned up, Carol. They know how now, and they know it makes good sense to do it, economically and politically. So no, Carol, the president will not withdraw his support for this drilling project. It makes economic sense for the country.
And who really cares a rat's ass for land that only a few hundred people have ever seen? He didn't add.
I have to talk to him personally about it, the science advisor insisted.
No. The chief of staff shook his head emphatically. That's not going to happen. Not on this issue. All you'd accomplish is to undercut your position, and that isn't smart, Carol.
But I promised.
Promised whom?
The Sierra Club.
Carol, the Sierra Club isn't part of this administration. And we get their letters. I've read them. They're turning into an extremist organization on issues like this. Anybody can say do nothing, and that's about all they're saying since this Mayflower guy took it over.
Kevin is a good man and a very smart one.
You couldn't prove that by me, Carol, the chief of staff snorted. He's a Luddite.
God damn it, Arnie, not everyone who disagrees with you is an extremist, okay?
Well, that one is. The Sierra Club's going to self-destruct if they keep him on top of the masthead. Anyway, the chief of staff checked his schedule. I have work to do. Your position on this issue, Dr. Breitling, is to support the administration. That means you personally support the drilling bill for AAMP. There is only one position in this building, and that position is what the president says it is. That's the price you pay for working as an advisor to the president, Carol. You get to influence policy, but once that policy is promulgated, you support it, whether you believe it or not. You will say publicly that you think that drilling that oil is a good thing for America and for the environment. Do you understand that?
No, Arnie, I won't, Breitling insisted.
Carol, you will. And you will do it convincingly, in such a way as to make the more moderate environmental groups see the logic of the situation. If, that is, you like working here.
Are you threatening me?
No, Carol, I am not threatening you. I am explaining to you how the rules work here. Because you have to play by the rules just like I do, and just like everyone else does. If you work here, you must be loyal to the president. If you are not loyal, then you cannot work here. You knew those rules when you came on board, and you knew you had to live by them. Okay, now it's time for a gut check. Carol, will you live by the rules, or won't you? Her face was red under the makeup. She hadn't learned to conceal her anger, the chief of staff saw, and that was too bad. You couldn't afford to get angry over minor bullshit items, not at this level of government. And this was a minor bullshit item. When you found something as valuable as several billion barrels of oil in a place that belonged to you, you drilled into the ground to get it out. It was as simple as that. And it was simpler still if the oil companies promised not to hurt anything as a result. It would remain that simple as long as the voters drove automobiles. "Well, Carol?" he asked.
"Yes, Arnie, I know the rules, and I will live by the rules," she confirmed at last.
"Good. I want you to prepare a statement this afternoon for release next week. I want to see it today. The usual stuff, the science of it, the safety of the engineering measures, that sort of thing." "Thanks for coming over, Carol," he said in dismissal. Dr. Breitling stood and moved to the door. She hesitated there, wanting to turn and tell Arnie what he could do with his statement. But she kept moving into the corridor in the west wing, turned north, and went down the stairs for the street level. Two Secret Service agents noted the look on her face and wondered what had rained on her parade that morning, or maybe had turned a hailstorm loose on it. She walked across the street with an unusually stiff gait, then up the steps into the OEOB.
In her office, she turned on her gateway computer and called up her word processing program, wanting to put her fist through the glass screen rather than type on the keyboard. To be ordered around by that man, who didn't know anything about science and didn't care about environmental policy. All Arnie cared about was politics, and politics was the most artificial damn thing in the world. But then, finally, she calmed down, took a deep breath, and began drafting her defense of something that, after all, would never happen, would it? No, she told herself. It would never happen. Chapter 12. Wild Cards. The theme park had learned well from its more famous model. It had taken care to hire away a dozen senior executives, their lavish salary increases paid for by the park's Persian Gulf financial backers, who had already exceeded their fiscal expectations and looked forward to recouping their total investment in less than 6 years instead of the programmed 8.5. Those investments had been considerable, since they determined not merely to emulate the American corporation, but to exceed it in every respect. The castle in their park was made of stone, not mere fiberglass. The main street was actually three thoroughfares, each adapted to three separate national themes. The circular railroad was of standard gauge and used two real steam locomotives, and there was talk of extending the line to the international airport, which the Spanish authorities had been so kind as to modernize in order to support the theme park. As well they might. The park provided 28,000 full-time and 10,000 more part-time or seasonal jobs. The ride attractions were spectacular, most of them custom-designed and built in Switzerland, and some of them adventurous enough to make a fighter pilot go pale. In addition, it had a Science World section, with a moonwalk attraction that had impressed NASA, an underwater walk-through mega aquarium, and pavilions from every major industry in Europe. The one from Airbus Industry was particularly impressive, allowing children, and adults, to pilot simulated versions of its aircraft. There were characters in costumes, gnomes, trolls, and all manner of mythical creatures from European history, plus Roman legionnaires to fight barbarians, and the usual marketing areas where guests could buy replicas of everything the park had to offer. One of the smartest things the investors had done was to build their theme park in Spain rather than France. The climate here, while hotter, was also sunny and dry most of the year, which made for full year-round operations. Guests flew in from all over Europe, or took the trains, or came down on bus tours to stay at the large, comfortable hotels, which were designed for three different levels of expense and grandeur, from one that might have been decorated by Cesar Ritz, down to several with more basic amenities. Guests at all of them shared the same physical environment, warm and dry, and could take time off to bathe in the many pools surrounded by white sand beaches, or to play on one of the two existing golf courses. Three more were under construction, and one of them would soon be part of the European professional tour. There was also a busy casino, something no other theme park had tried. All in all, World Park, as it was called, had been an instant and sensational success, and it rarely had fewer than 10,000 guests, and frequently more than 50,000. A thoroughly modern facility, it was controlled by six regional and one master command center, and every attraction, ride, and food outlet was monitored by computers and TV cameras. Mike Dennis was the operations director. He'd been hired away from Orlando, and while he missed the friendly managerial atmosphere there, the building and then running of World Park had been the challenge he'd waited for all his life. A man with three kids, this was his baby, Dennis told himself, looking out the battlements of the tower. His office and command center was in the castle keep, the tall tower in the 12th-century fortress they'd built. Maybe the Duke of Aquitaine had enjoyed a place like this, but he'd used only swords and spears, not computers and helicopters. And as wealthy as his grace had been back in the 12th century, he hadn't handled money in this quantity. World Park took in $10 million in cash alone on a good day, and far more than that from plastic. Every day a cash truck with a heavy police escort left the park for the nearest bank. Like its model in Florida, World Park was a multi-story structure. Under the main concourses was a subterranean city, where the support services operated, and the cast members changed into costumes and ate their lunches. And where he was able to get people and things from place to place quickly and unseen by the guests in the sunlight. Running it was the equivalent of being mayor of a not-so-small city. Harder, actually, since he had to make sure that everything worked all the time, and that the cost of operations was always less than the city's income. That he did his job well, actually about 2.1% better than his own pre-opening projections, meant that he had a sizable salary, and that he'd earned the $1 million bonus that had been delivered to him only 5 weeks earlier. Now, if only his kids could get used to the local schools. Even as an object of hatred, it was breathtaking. It was a city, Andre saw, the construction of which had cost billions. He'd lived through the indoctrination process in the local World Park University, learned the absurd ethos of the place, learned to smile at everything and everybody. He'd been assigned, fortuitously, to the security department, the notional World Park Policia, which means that he wore a light blue shirt and dark blue trousers with a vertical blue stripe, carried a whistle and a portable radio, and spent most of his time telling people where the restrooms were. Because World Park needed a police force about as much as a ship needed wheels. He'd gotten this job because he was fluent in three languages, French, Spanish, and English, and thus could be helpful to the majority of the visitors, guests, to this new Spanish city, all of whom needed to urinate from time to time, and most of whom, evidently, lacked the wit to notice the hundreds of signs, graphic rather than lettered, that told them where to go when the need became overwhelming. Esteban, Andre saw, was in his usual place, selling his helium-filled balloons. Bread and circuses, they both thought. The vast sums expended to build this place. And for what purpose? To give the children of the poor and working classes a few brief hours of laughter before they returned to their dreary homes? To seduce their parents into spending their money for mere amusement. Really, the purpose of the place was to enrich further the Arab investors who'd been persuaded to spend so much of their oil money here, building this fantasy city. Breathtaking, perhaps, but still an object of contempt, this icon of the unreal, this opiate for the masses of workers who had not the sense to see it for what it was. Well, that was the task of the revolutionary elite. Andre walked about, seemingly in an aimless way, but actually in accordance with plans, both his and the park's. He was being paid to look around and make arrangements, while he smiled and told parents where their little darlings could relieve themselves.
"This will do it," Noonan said, walking into the morning meeting. "What's this?" Clark asked. Noonan held up a computer floppy disk. "It's just 100 lines of code, not counting the installation stuff. The cells, the phone cells, I mean, all use the same computer program to operate. When we get to a place, I just insert this in their drives and upload the software. Unless you dial in the right prefix to make a call, 777 to be exact, the cell will respond that the number you're calling is busy. So we can block any cellular calls into our subjects from some helpful soul outside, and also prevent them from getting out."
"How many spare copies do you have?" Stanley asked.
30, Noonan answered. We can get the local cops to install them. I have instructions printed up in 6 languages. Not bad, eh? Noonan wanted to say. He'd gone through a contact at the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, to get it. Pretty good for just over a week's effort. It's called CellCop, and it'll work anywhere in the world. Good one, Tim. Clark made a note. Okay, how are the teams? Sam Houston's down with a sprained knee, Peter Covington told Clark. Hurt it coming down a zip line. He can still deploy, but he won't be running for a few days. Team 2's fully mission capable, John, Chavez announced. George Tomlinson is a little slowed down with his Achilles tendon, but no big deal. Clark grunted and nodded, making a further note. Training was so hard here that the occasional injury was inevitable. And John well remembered the aphorism that drills were supposed to be bloodless combat, and combat supposed to be bloody drills. It was fundamentally a good thing that his troops worked as hard in practice as they did in the real thing. It said a lot for their morale, and just as much for their professionalism, that they took every aspect of life in Rainbow that seriously. Since Sam Houston was a long rifleman, he really was about 70% mission capable, and George Tomlinson, strained tendon and all, was still doing his morning runs, gutting it out as an elite trooper should. Intel? John turned to Bill Tawney. Nothing special to report, the Secret Intelligence Service officer replied. We know that there are terrorists still alive, and the various police forces are still doing their investigations to dig them out. But it's not an easy job, and nothing promising appears to be underway, but one couldn't predict a break in a case. Everyone around the table knew that. This very evening, someone of the class of Carlos himself could be pulled over for running a stop sign and be recognized by some rookie cop and snapped up. But you couldn't plan for random events. There were still over 100 known terrorists living somewhere in Europe, probably, just like Ernst Model and Hans Fürkner. But they'd learned a not very hard lesson about keeping a low profile, adopting a simple disguise, and keeping out of trouble. They had to make some greater or lesser mistake to be noticed, and the ones who made dumb mistakes were long since dead or imprisoned.
How about cooperation with the local police agencies? Alistair Stanley asked.
We keep speaking with them, and the Bern and Vienna missions have been very good press for us. Wherever something happens, we can expect to be summoned swiftly.
Mobility? John asked next.
Well, that's me, I guess, Lieutenant Colonel Malloy responded. It's working out well with the 1st Special Operations Wing. They're letting me keep the Nighthawk for the time being, and I've got enough time on the British Puma that I'm current in it. If we have to go, I'm ready to go. I can get MC-130 tanker support if I need it for a long deployment, but as a practical matter, I can be just about anywhere in Europe in 8 hours in my Sikorsky, with or without tanker support. Operational side, I'm comfortable with things. The troops here are as good as any I've seen, and we work well together. The only thing that worries me is the lack of a medical team.
We've thought about that.
Dr. Bellow is our doc, and you're up to speed on trauma, right, Doc? Clark asked.
Fairly well. But I'm not as good as a real trauma surgeon. Also, when we deploy, we can get local paramedics to help out from police and fire services on the scene.
We did it better at Fort Bragg, Malloy observed. I know all our shooters are trained in emergency response care, but a properly trained medical corpsman is a nice thing to have around.
Dr. Bellow's only got 2 hands, the pilot noted, and he can only be in one place at a time.
When we deploy, Stanley said, we do a routine call-up to the nearest local casualty hospital. So far, we've had good cooperation.
Okay, guys, but I'm the one who has to transport the wounded. I've been doing it for a long time, and I think we could do it a little better.
I recommend a drill for that. We should practice it regularly.
That wasn't a bad idea, Clark thought.
Julie noted Malloy.
Al, let's do that in the next few days.
Agreed, Stanley responded with a nod.
The hard part is simulating injuries, Dr. Bellow told them. There's just no substitute for the real thing. But we can't put our people in the emergency room. It's too time-wasteful, and they won't see the right kind of injuries there.
We've had this problem for years, Peter Covington said. You can teach the procedures, but practical experience is too difficult to come by.
Yeah, unless we move the outfit to Detroit, Chavez quipped.
Look, guys, we all know the right first aid stuff, and Dr. Bellow is a doc. There's only so much we have time to train for, and the primary mission is paramount, isn't it? We get there and do the job, and that minimizes the number of wounds, doesn't it?
Except to the bad guys, he didn't add. And nobody really cared about them. And you couldn't treat 3 10-millimeter bullets in the head, even at Walter Reed.
I like the idea of training to evac wounded. Fine, we can do that. And practice first aid stuff. But can we realistically go farther than that? I don't see how.
Comments? Clark asked.
He didn't see much past that either.
Chavez is correct. But you're never fully prepared or fully trained, Malloy pointed out. No matter how much you work, the bad guys always find a way to dump something new on you. Anyway, in Delta we deploy with a full medical response team, trained corpsmen, experts, used to trauma care. Maybe we can't afford to do that here, but that's how we did it at Fort Bragg.
We'll just have to depend on local support for that, Clark said, closing the issue.
This place can't afford to grow that much. I don't have the funding.
And that's the magic word in this business, Malloy didn't have to add. The meeting broke up a few minutes later, and with it, the working day ended. Dan Malloy had grown accustomed to the local tradition of closing out a day at the club, where the beer was good and the company cordial. 10 minutes later, he was hoisting a jar with Chavez. This little greaser, he thought, really had his shit together.
That call you made in Vienna was pretty good, Ding.
Thanks, Dan. Chavez took a sip.
Didn't have much of a choice, though. Sometimes you just gotta do what you gotta do.
Yep, that's a fact, the Marine agreed.
You think we're thin on the medical side.
So do I. But so far that hasn't been a problem.
So far you've been lucky, my boy.
Yeah, I know. We haven't been up against any crazy ones yet.
Now, they're out there. The real sociopathic personalities. The ones who don't care a rat's ass about anything at all.
Well, truth is, I haven't seen any of them either except on TV. I keep coming back to the Malat thing in Israel 20-plus years ago. Those fuckers wasted little kids just to show how tough they were. And remember what happened a while back with the president's little girl? She was damned lucky that FBI guy was there. I wouldn't mind buying that guy a beer.
Good shooting, Chavez agreed.
Better yet, good timing. I read up on how he handled it. Talking to them and all, being patient, waiting to make his move, then taking it when he got it. He lectured at Bragg, but I was traveling that day. Saw the tape. The boys said he can shoot a pistol as well as anybody on the team. But better yet, he was smart.
Smart counts, Chavez agreed, finishing his beer.
I gotta go fix dinner.
Say again?
My wife's a doc, gets home in an hour or so, and it's my turn to do dinner.
A raised eyebrow.
Nice to see you're properly trained, Chavez.
I am secure in my masculinity, Domingo assured the aviator, and headed for the door.
Andre worked late that night. World Park stayed open until 2300 hours, and the shops remained open longer than that, because even so huge a place as World Park couldn't waste the chance to earn a few extra copper coins from the masses for the cheap,
worthless souvenirs they sold, to be clutched in the greedy hands of little children, often nearly asleep in the arms of their weary parents. He watched the process impassively, the way so many people waited until the very last ride on the mechanical contrivances, and only then, with the chains in place, and after the goodbye waves of the ride operators, did they finally turn and shuffle their way to the gates, taking every opportunity to stop and enter the shops, where the clerks smiled tiredly and were as helpful as they'd been taught to be at the World Park University. And then when, finally, all had left, the shops were closed and the registers emptied, and under the eyes of Andre and his fellow security staff, the cash was taken off to the counting room. It wasn't, strictly speaking, part of his current job, but he tagged along anyway, following the three clerks from the Matador shop, out onto the main street, then into an alleyway, through some blank wooden doors, and down the steps to the underground, the concrete corridors that bustled with electric carts and employees during the day, now empty, except for employees heading to dressing rooms to change into their street clothes. The counting room was at the very center, almost under the castle itself. There the cash was handed over, each bag labeled for its point of origin. The coins were dumped into a bin, where they were separated by nationality and denomination and counted, wrapped, and labeled for transport to the bank. The paper currency, already bundled by currency and denomination, was weighed. The first time he'd seen it, it had amazed him. But delicate scales actually weighed it. There, 1.0615 kilos of 100-mark German notes. 2.6370 kilos of 5-pound British ones. The corresponding amount was flashed on the electronic screen, and the notes were whisked off for wrapping. Here the security officers carried weapons, Astra pistols, because the total amount of the currency for the day was, the master tally display said, 11,567,309.35 pounds, all used cash, the very best sort in all denominations. It all fit into six large canvas bags that were placed on a four-wheeled cart for transport out the back of the underground into an armored car with a police escort for transport to the central branch of the local bank, still open this time of day for a deposit of this magnitude. 11 million British pounds in cash. This place took in billions per year in cash, Andre thought tiredly. Excuse me, he said to his security supervisor. Have I broken any rules by coming here? A chuckle. No. Everyone comes down sooner or later to see. That's why the windows are here. Is it not dangerous? I think not. The windows are thick, as you see, and security inside the counting room is very strict. Mon Dieu, all that money. What if someone should try to steal it? The truck is armored, and it has a police escort, two cars, four men each, all heavily armed. And those would be only the obvious watchers, Andre thought. There would be others, not so close and not so obvious, but equally well-armed. We were initially concerned that the Basque terrorists might try to steal the money. This much cash could finance their operations for years. But the threat has not developed, and besides, you know what becomes of all this cash. Why not fly the money to the bank on a helicopter? Andre asked. The security supervisor yawned. Too expensive. So what becomes of the cash? Much of it comes right back to us, of course. Oh. Andre thought for a moment. Yes, it must, mustn't it? World Park was largely a cash business, because so many people still preferred to pay for things that way, despite the advent of credit cards, which the park was just as pleased to use, and despite the ability of guests to charge everything to their hotel room accounts, instructions for which were printed on every plastic card key in the language of the individual guest. I wager we use the same 5-pound British note 15 times before it's too worn and has to be sent to London for destruction and replacement.
I see, Andre said with a nod. So we deposit, and then we withdraw from our own account just to make change for our guests. How much cash do we keep on hand, then?
For change purposes?
A shrug.
Oh, 2 or 3 million, at minimum. British pounds, that is. To keep track of it all, we have those computers.
He pointed.
Amazing place, Andre observed, actually meaning it. He nodded at his supervisor and headed off to punch his time card and change. It had been a good day. His wanderings had confirmed his previous observations of the park. He now knew how to plan the mission and how to accomplish it. Next, he had to bring in his colleagues and show them the plan, after which came the execution. 40 minutes later, he was in his flat, drinking some burgundy and thinking everything through. He'd been the plans and operations officer for Axion Direct for over a decade. He'd planned and executed a total of 11 murders. This mission, however, would be by far the grandest of all, perhaps the culmination of his career. And he had to think it all through. Affixed to the wall of his flat was a map of World Park, and his eyes wandered over it, back and forth. Way in, way out. Possible routes of access by the police. Ways to counter them. Where to place his own security personnel. Where to take the hostages. Where to keep them. How to get everyone out. Andre kept going over it again and again, looking for weaknesses, looking for mistakes. The Spanish National Police, the Guardia Civil, would respond to this mission. They were to be taken with respect, despite their comical hats. They'd been fighting the Basques for a generation, and they'd learned. They doubtless had an arrangement with World Park already, because this was too obvious a target for progressive elements, Andre corrected himself. Police were not to be taken lightly. They'd almost killed or arrested him twice in France, but both of those occasions were because he'd made obvious mistakes. And he'd learned from both of them. No, not this time. He'd keep them at bay this time by his choice of hostages, and by showing his willingness to use them to his political ends. And as tough as the Guardia Civil might be, they would quail before that demonstration of resolve. Because tough as they were vulnerable to bourgeois sentimentality, just as all like them were. It was the purity of his purpose that gave him the edge, and he'd hold on to that. And he would achieve his objective, or many would die. And neither the government of Spain nor France could stand up to that. The plan was nearly ready. He lifted his phone and made an international call. Pete came back early in the evening. His face was pale now, and he was even more listless, but also uncomfortable, judging from the pained way in which he moved. "How you feeling?" Dr. Kilgore asked cheerily.
"Stomach is real bad, Doc, right here," Pete said, pointing with his finger.
"Still bothering you, eh? Well, okay, why don't you lie down here and we'll check you out?" the physician said, donning mask and gloves. The physical examination was cursory, but unnecessary for all that. Pete, like Chester before him, was dying, though he didn't know it yet. The heroin had done a good job of suppressing his discomfort, removing the pain and replacing it with chemical nirvana. Kilgore carefully took another blood sample for later microscopy.
"Well, partner, I think we just have to wait this one out. But let me give you a shot to ease the pain, okay?"
"Sure thing, Doc. And the last one worked pretty good." Kilgore filled another plastic syringe and injected the heroin into the same vein as before. He watched Pete's brown eyes go wide with the initial rush, then droop as the pain went away, to be replaced with a lethargy so deep that he could almost have done major surgery on the spot without getting a rise from the poor bastard. "How are the rest of the guys, Pete?"
"Okay, but Charlie is bitching about his stomach. Something he ate, I guess."
Oh, yeah? Maybe I'll see him, too, Kilgore thought. So, number three will be in here tomorrow, probably. The timing was just about right. After Chester's earlier-than-expected symptoms, the rest of the group was right on the predicted timeline. Good. More telephone calls were made, and by early morning people rented cars with false IDs, drove in pairs or singly south from France to Spain, and were waved through the cursory border checkpoints, usually with a friendly smile. Various travel agents made the necessary reservations at park hotels, all mid-level, and linked to the park by monorail or train, the stations right in the shop-filled hotel lobbies, so that the guests wouldn't get lost. The highways to the park were wide and comfortable to drive on, and the signs easy to follow, even for those who didn't speak Spanish. About the only hazards were the huge tourist buses, which moved along at over 150 kilometers per hour, like land-bound ocean liners, their windows full of people, many of them children who waved down at the drivers of the passenger cars. The drivers waved back with smiles of their own, and allowed the buses to plow on, exceeding the speed limit as though it were their right to do so, which the car drivers didn't want to risk. They had plenty of time. They'd planned their mission that way. Tomlinson reached down to his left leg and grimaced. Chavez dropped back from the morning run to make sure he was okay. "Still hurts?" "Like a son of a bitch," Sergeant Tomlinson confirmed. "So go easier on it, you dumb bastard. The Achilles is a bad thing to hurt." "Just found that one out, Ding." Tomlinson slowed down to a walk, still favoring the left leg after running over 2 miles on it. His breathing was far heavier than usual, but pain was always a bad thing for the endurance. "See Doc Bello?" "Yeah, but ain't nothing he can do except let it heal," he says. "So let it heal. That's an order, George. No more running until it stops hurting so much, okay?" "Yes, sir," Sergeant Tomlinson agreed. "I can still deploy if you need me." "I know that, George. See you in the shooting house." "Right." Tomlinson watched his leader speed up to rejoin the rest of Team Two. It hurt his pride that he wasn't keeping up. He'd never allowed any sort of injury to slow him down. In Delta Force, he'd kept up with the training despite 2 broken ribs. Hadn't even told the medics about it for fear of being thought a pussy by the rest of his team. But while you could conceal and gut out bad ribs, a stretched tendon was something you couldn't run on. The pain was just so bad that the leg stopped working right, and it was hard to stand up straight. "Damn," the soldier thought. "Can't let the rest of the team down." He'd never been second best in anything in his life, back to Little League Baseball, where he'd played shortstop. But today, instead of running the rest of the way, he walked, trying to maintain a military 120 steps per minute. And even that hurt, but not enough to make him stop. Team One was out running also, and they went past him. Even Sam Houston with his bad knee, limping as he ran past with a wave. The pride in this unit was really something. Tomlinson had been a special ops trooper for 6 years, a former Green Beret drafted into Delta, now almost a college graduate with a major in psychology. That was the field special ops people tended to adopt for some reason or other, and was trying to figure out how to complete his studies in England, where the universities worked differently, and where it was a little unusual for enlisted soldiers to have parchment degrees. But in Delta they often sat around and talked about the terrorists they were supposed to deal with, what made them tick, because in understanding that came the ability to predict their actions and weaknesses, the easier to kill them, which was the job after all. Strangely, he'd never done a takedown in the field before coming here, and stranger still, the experience hadn't been at all different from training. "You played as you practiced," the sergeant thought, just like they'd told him every step of the way since basic training at Fort Knox 11 years before.
Damn, his lower leg was still on fire, but less so than it had been in the run. Well, the doc had told him at least a week, more likely two, before he'd be fully mission-capable again, all because he'd hit a curb the wrong way, not looking like a damned fool. At least Houston had an excuse for his knee. Ziplining could be dangerous, and everybody slipped once in a while. In his case, landing on a rock, which must have hurt like a bastard. But Sam wasn't a quitter either, Tomlinson told himself, hobbling forward toward the shooting house. "Okay, this is a live-fire exercise," Chavez told Team 2. "The scenario is 5 bad guys, 8 hostages. The bad guys are armed with handguns and SMGs. 2 of the hostages are kids, 2 girls, ages 7 and 9. Other hostages are all females, mothers. The bad guys hit a daycare center, and it's time to do the takedown. Noonan has predicted the location of the bad guys like this." Chavez pointed to the blackboard. "Tim, how good's your data?"
70%. No better than that. They're moving around some. But the hostages are all here in this corner." His pointer tapped the blackboard. "Okay. Patty, you got the explosives. Pair off as normal. Louis and George go in first, covering the left side. Eddie and I go in right behind with the center. Scotty and Oso in last, covering the right. Questions?" There were none. The team members examined the blackboard diagram. The room was straightforward, or as much as it could be. "Then let's do it," Ding told them. The team filed out, wearing their ninja suits.
"Your leg, George. How is it?" Loisel asked Tomlinson.
"We'll just have to see, I guess. But my hands are okay," the sergeant said, holding his MP10 up.
"Bien." Loisel nodded.
The two were semi-permanently paired together and worked well as a mini-team, almost to the point that one of them could read the other's mind in the field, and both had the gift for moving unseen. That was difficult to teach. Instinctive hunters just knew it somehow, and the good ones practiced it incessantly. 2 minutes later, they were on the outside of the shooting house. Connolly set the primacord around the door. This aspect of training kept the base carpenters pretty busy, Chavez thought. It took only 30 seconds before Connolly backed off, waving his hand, thumb up, to indicate he'd connected the wires to the detonator box. "Team 2, this is lead," they all heard over their radio earpieces. "Stand 2 and stand by. Patty, 3, 2, 1, mark." Clark, as usual, jumped when the kaboom sounded. A former demolitions expert himself, he knew that Connolly was his superior, with an almost magical touch for the stuff. But he knew also that no demo expert in the world ever used too little on a job. The door flew across the room and slammed into the far wall, fast enough to cause injury to anyone it hit, though probably not fatally. John covered his ears with his hands and shut his eyes because next through was a flashbang that attacked his ears and eyes like an exploding sun. He had the timing down perfectly as he opened back up to see the shooters come in. Tomlinson ignored the protests from his leg and followed Loisel in with his weapon up. That's when the first surprise hit the shooters. This exercise was to be a tricky one. No hostages and no bad guys on the left. Both men went to the far wall, turning right to cover that side. Chavez and Price were already in, scanning their area of responsibility, and also seeing nothing. Then Vega and McTyler had the same experience on the right side of the room. The mission was not going as briefed, as sometimes happened. Chavez saw there were no bad guys or hostages in view, and that there was but one door open into another room. "Patty, flashbangs now," he ordered over his radio, while Clark watched from the corner wearing his white observer shirt and body armor. Connolly had come through behind Vega and McTyler, 2 flashbangs in his hands. One, then another, sailed through the door, and again the building shook. Chavez and Price took the lead this time. Alistair Stanley was in there in his white don't-shoot-at-me garb while Clark stayed in the front room.
The latter heard the suppressed chatter of the weapons, followed by shouts of, "Clear!"